You've been listening to Press Watch, going out to you via the terrestrial transmitter on your personal untrackable, relatively untrackable, radio. And also via the World Wide Web to all the ships at sea.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland with just 1 minute to go before 10 o'clock. We're about 15 minutes away from Flashpoints. Today, historian Alfred McCoy on the real American exceptionalism and its roots in Nazi Germany. A look at the national movement to shut down killer drone operations and a commentary on actor Sean Penn's racist comment at the Academy Awards. Between the Covers, host on 11, David Naiman speaks with Sarah Gerard about her new novel, Binary Star, an account of a young woman struggling with anorexia and her long-distance alcoholic boyfriend. At 11:30 today, the film show features Carla Rossi, a.k.a. Anthony Hudson, on the Queer Horror Festival. Also, local filmmaking brothers Sean and Christoph Whiteman talk about their first feature, Childhood Machine. And POWFest Tara Johnson Mettinger talks about the next generation of women filmmakers. That's all coming up, but up next, we believe, is Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary, and that is coming up. By the way, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Clackamas Community College Theater presenting the Laramie Project, a stage production based on extensive interviews of citizens of Laramie, Wyoming, in the aftermath of the murder of Matthew Shepard in 1998. The Laramie Project runs through March 8th at the Osterman Theater, and ticket information is available at clackamas.edu/theater or by calling 503-594-3158.
KBOO is a proud sponsor with Runaway Productions of Northwest Hip Hop Fest 4, February 27, 2015 at the Hawthorne Theater, 1507 Southeast 39th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. Bad Habitat, Tope, Speaker Minds, Mike Crenshaw, Kinetic MCs, Glenn Waco, Pale Soul, Flowmatic, Diction, Destro, Gums, Soul Miner, and many more. February 27th, 2015 at the Hawthorne Theater, Northwest Hip Hop Fest 4. Starts at 9 p.m. and is 21 and up.
Points the real American exceptionalism and its roots in Nazi Germany and the Third Reich. We'll hear about, we'll meet Carl Schmitt. We're going to want to remember him as we look at U.S. foreign policy. Also, a national mobilization of nonviolent resistance to shut down killer drone operations everywhere. And Miguel Gavilán Molina takes on Sean Penn's blatant racism at the recent Academy Awards. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Coming up in just a minute, we're going to be reaching out to Alfred McCoy. We're having a little trouble making the connection there, but hopefully we will get to him soon. So what we've decided to do here is start the show with a commentary by our own Miguel Gavilán Molina, who was not crazy about the comments by Sean Penn at the recent Academy Awards, and he's got a commentary about that. Miguel.
This past Sunday night, Hollywood broadcast its annual extravaganza celebrating the 8th annual Academy Awards. For 87 years, Hollywood has been honoring its best and brightest talent with a gold statue that is monochromatic, scuse, since it has been presented to very few people of color. Underneath all the glitz of the spectacle of fantasy where the rich and beautiful come together to glorify their achievements lies an ugly truth. In 2015, it is still a whitewashed affair. From both in front of and behind the camera, Hollywood is woefully inept at examining its own internalized racism. I don't care how many people of color have been trotted out on stage to prove the C, we're not racist, or the infamous, some of my best friends are of color, points. I've had that move pulled on myself and seen it done to others 100 times over. Those of us who are in touch with who we are see right through the crap in designer clothes. As many of you already know, the top honor went to Birdman, featuring Michael Keaton. In short, the film is about a Hollywood has-been staging a comeback. Great performances. But in a movie that is basically a film about itself, was it really worth 9 nominations? You be the judge. But then, there's the film Selma, about an event that changed the course of history in this country, with cinematography and performances that were heralded in every corner. It barely got a nod from the Academy. This forced black community leaders to rise up and demand a reason for the lack of recognition. Even with the backdrop of Black History Month, Selma was overlooked, with none of its actors considered. The numbers speak for themselves, both in front of and behind the camera. Of the 6,000-plus members of the Academy membership, only 6% are non-white. Numbers of black that have won Academy Awards since 1929, 15. Numbers of Latinos, 4. Asians, 3. Sorry, Native Americans, you're not even on the list. Nonetheless, it was Alejandro González Iñárritu, a man of color, a Mexican that stole the show, winning for Best Director of Birdman. John Legend and Common reminded us of the need to speak truth to power when reminding us that the performers have a responsibility to use their craft and their connections to help each other and create change that will better the world. There were a few reality checks written out for us. Rapper Common sobered us up when he accepted his award by reminding us that almost 50 years after Dr. King's assassination, we still struggle with racial inequality as well as the highest rates of mass incarceration of black men. These simple messages seemed to right over the heads of those gathered in their tuxedos and glamorous gowns, collectively starstruck and applauding on cue like robots. It would seem that in Hollywood, people of color are regulated to window dressing and the punchline of jokes. Sean Penn, upon introducing the winner for Best Director, blathers, "Who gave this son of a bitch a green card?" Those of us who were beyond offended were told to relax, that it was a joke, to chill, that they're friends. For me, it was the most offensive comment I could imagine. It reminded me of a lifetime of racism and disrespect heaped on me and my family. We must see this comment for what it is and who it came from, because of the fact that it was made by one of the most public stages in the world, the Oscars. In Mexican culture, especially when translated into Spanish, it is one of the most uncouth, rudest comments ever. It was insensitive because Sean Penn is a privileged white man. White men have no boundaries. Many white men and women still feel that the onus of political correctness and culture sensitivity do not apply to them. It does on all levels. We are not window dressing or a spice to flavor your dreary white lives. We're a force to be reckoned with. Members of the Academy, are you listening? This is Miguel Gavilan Molina for Flashpoints.
And you are listening.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Thanks, Miguel. Coming up next, we'll be speaking with Alfred McCoy. Stay with us. And we're back. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And now we turn our attention to the real American exceptionalism and its roots in Nazi Germany. And we are honored to be joined by Professor Alfred McCoy. Professor McCoy, he teaches history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His books include Torture and Impunity, The U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation and Policing, and Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. Well, it is good to have you with us, Professor McCoy. Welcome to Flashpoints.
Great to be with you.
All right. Well, let's see if we can get a definition of what we're talking about when we're talking about the real American exceptionalism. That's the title of the article that just appeared in TomDispatch.com. What do we mean? And tell us something about Carl Schmitt.
Sure. Carl Schmitt was and is a very famous political theorist. He was also a chief jurist for the Nazis, and a strong supporter of the Third Reich, and a lifelong anti-Semite. But he said very famously, "The sovereign is he who decides the exception." And after World War II, because of our great victory in that war, we became the world sovereign. And the United States laid down most of the institutional infrastructure and the laws for what we now call the international community. And at the same time, the United States also began violating those very same laws, violating the rules and regulations of the same institutions, the same international order that we were in the process of creating. Because as the world sovereign, we had, in our own view, the sole right to decide the exceptions to those international laws and regulations.
Now, the United States initially, certainly in some regards, really set the tone for international law, where they defined the nature of international law, and I guess now they have become the major breaker of that law.
I think it's safe to say that more than any other single nation on the planet, the United States breathed the idea of the international community into being. You know, right from, let's say, going back to 1899, at the first Geneva Peace, Hague Peace Conference in the Netherlands, the U.S. delegate came up with the idea of a permanent court of arbitration. Later on, the U.S. Secretary of State, Elihu Root, more than any other individual, was the architect of both U.S. global power and the U.S. international system. He had the idea that there should be a permanent court of international justice, which was finally established in 1920. After World War II, the United States played, of course, a central and seminal role in the establishment of the United Nations. We drafted, more than any other single nation, the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We played a key role in the Geneva Conventions. And if you add to that the World Bank, the World Health Organization, and the World Trade Organization and its predecessors, all of that added up together is basically the international community. So we wrote the laws and we created the international infrastructure. And at the very same time that we were doing all that, we began breaking those very same laws, defying those very same institutions. And I could give you a couple examples.
Well, why don't you give us a couple of examples?
So, the clearest one is the issue of torture. Now, this is a seemingly small act. I mean, a small number of interrogators inflict horrible pain on a single individual in an obscure place. And so it seems like that such a small act couldn't have such central importance. But indeed it does. For 300 years, this has been a powerful symbolic issue in which reformers have campaigned for states around the world to give up the right to torture. And so in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the UN, in which Eleanor Roosevelt played a key role in the drafting, there is a specific prohibition on torture, just as it is in the Geneva Conventions. So the UN Universal Declaration, 1948, a year later are the Geneva Conventions, and then in the early 1950s, the United States simultaneously and secretly began conducting research whose sum produced a new doctrine, the first breakthrough in the cruel science of pain and censure, a doctrine of psychological torture. And that was codified in a CIA manual by 1962 and disseminated through the U.S. intelligence community and worldwide among allied agencies. So at a certain point, the Amnesty International seems to be following in the trail of CIA torture training programs around the world as it campaigns for the end of torture. Okay, another example is the key principle in this international community of nations is that the world gets divided into sovereign states who have inviolable sovereignty, inviolable control over their own territory. At the same time, the United States helped create the United Nations that enshrined this principle. President Dwight Eisenhower conducted 104 covert operations, which were designed to deal with this fundamental contradiction in the global system. Here we were, the world hegemon, which meant that we had to exercise unequal power over secondary and subordinate nations, and yet we were creating an international system in which you couldn't violate national sovereignty. So how do you mediate that contradiction? How do you intervene when you couldn't and shouldn't intervene? And the answer is CIA covert operations. So, for example, under President Eisenhower, he launched several invasions of the People's Republic of China, turning northeastern Burma into kind of a involuntary launching pad for these operations. Later on, the Eisenhower administration decided they would split up Indonesia into maybe three separate countries and had a massive intervention in that country supporting secessionist rebels. We overthrew legally elected governments in Iran and Guatemala. And those are just, four.
I mean, if you're talking about, some of these overthrows, if you're talking about Indonesia, where essentially the rivers of that country ran red with the amount of killing that took place as a part of this policy, right? This was no small operation.
No, right. And that was the second time. We failed in 1957 to partition the country. So, in effect, what we did is 8 years later, we allied with the Indonesian military, and we used our resources, particularly our psychological warfare sources, in order to spark a bloodbath led by the Indonesian military that killed up to 1 million people and destroyed the largest communist party outside the Soviet Union. And, of course, many innocent people were swept up in that bloodbath. That was the system we established. So right from the beginning, we wrote the rules, and we reserved to ourselves the right, the sole right, to break those same rules. And, I think you can say, all right, that it's almost an axiom that there is a fundamental contradiction between secrecy and the rule of law.